Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
This is John Paul.
And this is an X Tuesday episode and long awaited, long planned. Even though I haven't quite finished putting out all the Age of X-Men episodes, I did want to get started before I fall even further behind, more than a year, to the whole House of X, Powers of X, Dawn of X stuff. And John Paul being our sort of resident expert on the X-Men. As it were, and he's read all this and really enjoyed it. And so we were just talking before we started recording. That's really what we wanted. I have only read the first, as of when we're recording this, I have only read the first issue of House of X and Powers of X. So I'm coming at it from a very different perspective, where John Paul is much further down the line. He's almost caught up with current stuff, and you know, he's seen the payoff. So how does it work when, you know, somebody has been on the journey going back and rereading these issues and somebody experiencing it for the first time? So let's just get your, if you can remember, like when you first read this, John Paul, what were your initial, were you kind of like confused? Like what's going on? Cause that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm reading it and I'm just not sure where we're going.
That's about right. I mean, thinking about it, I'm especially more of the Powers of 10, that first issue, like really confused me because I already know who these characters are. And I'm like, what is she talking about? But we'll get into that later.
Yeah. And the other part is, you know, I've finished reading Age of X-Men. Even though I haven't, you know, recorded all the episodes for those issues, I did go ahead and finish reading all of them. And I finished Rosenberg's Uncanny, which I really, really loved, just to see, okay, where's the setup for this? You know, because Hickman, he definitely plays the long game. We saw when he finally got to his giant Secret War story, he had, you know, started building it in Avengers all the way through Fantastic Four. Basically, all the work he'd ever done at Marvel was building up to that Secret War. So he definitely plays the long game. But he always did it within the context of the story. So I wanted to see, hey, is there anything that happened in Nadler and Thompson's Age of X-Men that hints toward this? And the way that ends, I almost thought, okay, well, there's a certain thing that is set up there with Nate Gray and Magneto kind of staying behind in that world, in that universe of Age of X-Men, saying, hey, we're going to try again. It didn't work the first time. We're going to try again. Like, could that effort to try again have been what spawned Hickman's? I mean, I thought it was a possibility till I read these first two issues, and they just seemed so wildly different in tone and everything that I thought, okay, that's not really a possibility. Read the end of Rosenberg's, you know, and that seems to be a more direct prologue to this. But again, it's nothing is hinted at. We get no sort of clues beyond, you know, just the general thing that you think about the X-Men. Well, you know, they're tired of being persecuted. And in fact, Magneto even says something, I think it's in House of X number one, where he says something along the lines, it's actually Cyclops. That's who it is. Cyclops says to the Fantastic Four, you know, we're tired of being persecuted. You know, we're actually the superior race, if you will. Did you think we were just going to take it forever? You know, and I love that line because it's so,
yeah, true. Me too.
It's so true. So, but beyond that, I didn't think there was anything in Rosenberg's series that really foreshadowed this. So in a way, this sort of comes out of nowhere. So I think that's why it's a little discordant for me to read these first couple issues and go, wait, what's going on? What's happening? And then on top of that, you put the big ideas that Hickman always has where, so he didn't do this as much in his Marvel work, at least not at first, but he always did it in his, you know, independent work, Nowhere Men. And I think Nowhere Men's him, but he definitely did it East of West, where you get these data pages, these data dumps that give you, and he's a big fan of design and, you know, graphic design and that kind of thing. And so he sort of designed symbols, and there's a whole Krakoan language that you know, we're introduced to in the first issue. So, you know, well, I mean, I'm not a big fan of that sort of stuff. I never have been. I like all my information to come within the story, but I understand that for you, when you're talking about the limited real estate of a comic book, you know, it, you can get a lot more information by just putting a paragraph of prose there with some cool, you know, design elements and say, okay, here's what you need to know. Like we're told about the three drugs in one of those. And it gives you way more information than you would have, because that's something that some people will complain about, you know, oh, there's so much exposition and it can be awkward, you know, when one person is telling another person, hey, there's a new drug and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't sound natural. Somebody just giving you that data dump. So I can see why he does it, but I've never been a fan of it in comics, but I think you feel differently about it.
Well, I honestly think it's because, you know, I'm a little more fresh on comic books. I've been around comic books all my life, but only like last 3.5 years have I really been reading them on a weekly basis. So for me, it does give that extra bit of information that you just can't do with like a 16-page comic book and no matter how many panels you throw out.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. It's, I mean, we're talking about, he's given us knowledge that would take months and months, if not years, to sort of ingrain. And it goes back, and this actually ties into what we were saying before about the fact that his narrative, his ideas, his sort of, you know, big overarching plot of this, it's such a departure from everything that's come before. Because if you want to plant these ideas, like, I don't know, the X-Men being persecuted, or the techno-organic virus. Let's go there. That's a great example. I mean, that was a subplot that, you know, you start planning ideas a year or two ahead of time and you drop little clues all along to build up to it, because then you can build that knowledge base. When you're talking, okay, we're going to end Age of X-Men and Matthew Rosenberg's Uncanny 1 month, and then we're going to start up Hickman's Powers of X and House of X the next month, then yeah, you've got you don't have that time to build it up, right? It's just gonna start. And the other thing about it is Hickman was planning this for a long time, and the other writers that come on board after we get through Hawks and Pox, and you get to the Dawn of X, and he brings on a bunch of other writers to, you know, to write the various series. They were all workshopping together and talking about the story and the plot, and Hickman's kind of show running everything. The whole time, like when X-Men Disassembled started, when you had, who was it? I guess it was Rosenberg, Ed Brisson, and was it Kelly Thompson, I think, that was the other writer? Yeah. So when they came on to X-Men and all the other X titles shut down and they just had that weekly Uncanny that was the X-Men Disassembled storyline, you know, they stopped X-Men Gold and X-Men Blue and X-Men Red and all the other titles ended. Like when those three writers came on, they knew that they had a finite amount of time, because Hickman's story was going to come out, you know, and that was a thing. So I have been going back and reading some of Hickman's stuff and putting the episodes out on it, or not Hickman rather, but Rosenberg. And what's fascinating to me is, as popular as the Hickman stuff has been, because it's such a departure, and I think it's really easy for X fans because it's insular, you know, it doesn't really tie into the rest of the Marvel universe. You don't have to read anything else. And it makes it kind of easier to understand, being that it's sort of siloed. And it's been really popular. Sales on it have been great, but I had a number of people that reach out to me that said, yeah, that Rosenberg Uncanny is actually, they like it better than the Hickman stuff. And I'm not going to say, I don't know that I like it better or not. What I know is that Rosenberg run, even though it was only, you know, 10 issues or whatever it was, it feels so much like the classic era, like the classic Chris Claremont era of X-Men, because everything is about relationships. And Rosenberg's a, you know, huge fan. It's clear he's hugely influenced by that era. And so it's not a surprise that a lot of people get that vibe off of it. But it did surprise me how many people said, yeah, I like it better than what Hickman's doing. And not a huge amount of people, you know, but it was a handful of people. So I'm kind of curious if I'll come out to that end too. And it might just be because this is so different than what we've seen before. I mean, and I know, because I have read a little, you know, you and I have talked about it I have read a little. Like, I read the first issue of X Factor, which obviously, you know, is far past what I read here. And I read the first issue of Ten of Swords. So I have a little bit of idea about how, you know, people are rebirthed or regenerated or what have you. I know that, you know, there's their own, you know, nation in Krakoa, and only mutants can go there. Cause I read Fantastic Four, and, you know, Franklin turns out he thought it was a mutant. Now they're saying he's not a mutant. He can't go there anymore. So I have a little bit of an idea of what's going on, but not, I don't have all the knowledge. I haven't read the House of now, is it House of 10 or is it House of X? Cause I've heard it both ways. You know,
the way I've heard it, majority is House of X, Powers of 10.
Gotcha.
Because it's House of Xavier.
Gotcha. And
Powers of 10. I don't know why, what the 10 is about, but okay.
Well, you know, when I started going through the Powers book, it starts off and it says, you know, X zero. So X, like the letter X to the zero power. And that's year one.
Right. Oh.
And so maybe the powers, it's saying it's year 10 is what I'm thinking. Maybe X to the 10. Yeah. I'm not sure. But we'll talk about that one. We'll talk about the Powers book in the next episode. We're going to go through House of X number one first. So let me find the credits. Obviously written by Jonathan Hickman. As I said, we have Pepe Larraz on art. Martea Garcia handles the colors, Clayton Cowles on letters, Tom Muller designs, and there's a whole crap ton of variant covers. I'm not going to go through all the different ones, but I think I bought the Mark Brooks cover because why would I?
Same.
Why wouldn't I? Because it's Mark Brooks. So
same. Yeah.
So it, really great cover. We see this sort of new version, which is interesting to me, this new version of the five. Like when you think about it, the original five, you know, Cyclops, Marvel Girl or Jean Grey, Beast, Angel, Iceman, you think of them as the original five. You don't really think of Professor X as an actual X-Man. But one thing that I haven't heard too many people talk about in this whole era of X-Men, this Hickman era, is how, I mean, I did hear some people speculate, is it really Professor X? Because he has this giant fishbowl on his head that has an X on it, but he's walking around like nobody has. I haven't seen anybody anyway talking about the fact, like, okay, this guy doesn't have to be in a wheelchair anymore. Like right away, that it changes him as a character. He, to me, in this series, from what I've, and again, it's only been a couple issues, but he seems so much younger and kind of more of a force. And on the cover, we get Cyclops, Marvel Girl, and Cyclops is probably the character that's most in the background, followed by the character that's next most in the background, be Wolverine, and then Marvel Girl, Jean Grey, and then Magneto, and then leading them is Professor X. So I do find it interesting. I don't know if that's just the way Pepe Larraz designed it, or if Hickman, I mean, knowing Hickman, he's such a control guy and likes the stories to be told in such a way that I wouldn't surprise me to hear that he dictated this order. Because it's almost in power level, you know, like Professor X is the most powerful, and then Magneto, then Jean Grey. The inclusion of Wolverine is interesting, but they have, it seems like they've been leveling, Marvel's been leveling him up in recent years, having him be involved with Infinity Gems and all that. And Cyclops is way in the back. As far as, you know, seeing Iceman or Beast or Angel, they're nowhere to even be seen. So I did notice that. I mean, we're talking about a new dawn, you know, dawning of a new era of the X-Men, and it's still five people on the cover, but not the five you necessarily would expect. So then when we get to the first page, it is one of those sort of design pages. Now we get a quote from Professor X saying, "Humans of the planet Earth, while you slept, the world changed." So I don't know if that's supposed to be a clue to how quickly this all happened in terms of there is no transition, like I said. Just from one day to the next, they wake up and the world changed. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but Professor X was still dead from Cyclops having killed him. And now all of a sudden we, you know, get to this story and he's there. And the first page sort of...
Well, from my understanding, he came back in Astonishing X-Men, through Phantom X's body.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, you're right. And it wasn't 100%. Yeah, somebody had given up their life and he had come back, but it was, yeah, there were some questions about it. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Anyway, we get to the first page and we see some, looks like these glowing cocoons. And then all of a sudden, light sort of pops out of them. It looks like they're hatching. And it looks like they're part of some tree, for lack of a better term. And they kind of remind me of the pods from The Matrix, in a way. And we see a bunch of these pods sort of interwoven in the roots of the tree. And we see who appears to be Professor X there, standing there watching these pods hatch. And we see a man and a woman. The woman has red hair. I'm assuming that's Jean Grey. I believe the man to be Cyclops, because on the next page, Professor X sort of lifts his chin and we see a little spark of red there from his eyes. So as we look at that page, Professor X is sort of standing over them, and there's apparently more pods hatching, because we see an arm reaching out from off panel, and then a woman with brunette hair, and then a couple of other guys. And Professor X says, "To me, my X-Men." He has a little bit of a smile on his face. And again, real interesting choice of pose here, being that Professor X is standing above them. It's almost like they're just at his feet, you know, in like supplication, having just awoken. It's such a interesting image, like they're worshiping him or something. And it gives me a creepy vibe about Professor X, and that I've had ever since I read these two issues. So
it takes a while for that to go away.
Really?
Yeah, that creepy vibe lingers for a while. And it took a while for me to like, oh, okay. You know? Yeah. But yeah,
that's interesting, 'cause it's a different vibe. I mean, when I did say, when we covered Marvel Superhero Secret Wars, that was the sort of the worst characterization I'd ever seen of Professor X, and that Jim Shooter did in the mid 80s. And it just seems such a departure from who Professor X was in the regular X-Men comics. He just seems so almost malevolent. And this is different. He seemed kind of militant and just angry. And this, he just seems sort of, I don't want to say evil, but I guess I'd say Machiavellian, you know, like he's the puppet master. So anyway, next page is credits. And again, very Hickman-esque in its design. And if you've ever seen any of his pages, go look at the design of this page and go look at East of West. And there definitely are similarities there. And then we get a series of flashbacks. As 5 months ago, we see Colossus picking a flower. 4 months ago in Westchester. So, you know, obviously where the X-Mansion used to be on Gray Malkin Lane. Storm is carrying a flower. 3 months ago, Blue Area of the Moon. It looks like somebody is planting a similar looking flower. Nightcrawler, based on the number of fingers. And then 2 months ago on Mars, looks like we have Armor planting a flower on Mars as well. And then 1 month ago, in the Savage Land, we see, it looks like the flower has been planted. I think this is supposed to be Beast. And it seems to be growing some sort of plant. And then 3 weeks ago, Washington, D.C., again, we see flowers already planted, plants starting to grow. Kitty Pryde sitting there looking at the Washington Monument and either the sunrise or the sunset. And the only way we know it's Kitty is because Lockheed the Dragon is there as well. Then 2 weeks ago, we see a couple of the cuckoos planting flowers. I don't know exactly where that is. And then on the final panel of that page, it says the Jerusalem Habitat. And we see the four cuckoos there walking into a building that it looks like it has this plant that has grown alongside, you know, up sort of over the building. And then when we come to now, the plant clearly has taken over the building. It's growing. It's just huge. It's flowering. It looks sort of like a cypress tree in the way that it grows. And we see some limousines pull up and these VIPs get out there, ambassadors, and they're sort of talking to each other. Hey, you look tired. How was your flight? Blah, blah, blah. And we get a pretty big exposition dump. One of the ambassadors tells us that Charles Xavier delivered a telepathic message to the whole world, and it's an offer they can't refuse. And they're all invited to come to this habitat that they didn't even know existed. and recognize the sovereignness of the nation state of Krakoa. And it doesn't necessarily say that here. It just says the sovereignty of a nation state they'd never heard of till 4 days ago. And how's the saying go? May you live in interesting times. And I'm not going to blame Hickman for the pandemic, but dude, we're living in interesting times right now. Not in a good way. So I always think, I think about that a lot these days. Interesting that Hickman chose that turn of phrase. And then another ambassador, I'm going to put that in quotes, ambassador shows up. And she says, personally, I'd settle for a bit of predictability, good night's sleep. Can't see these things happening. And they're sort of talking amongst themselves about what's been offered. And this is where we learn about the drug. And supposedly it extends human life for 5 years, it prevents diseases of the mind. And it's also the most adaptive antibiotic the world's ever seen. So you say it's a problem. I would call it a gift. That's what the Chinese ambassador said. And they're like, yeah, but it's not a gift if you have to pay. And Xavier is only offering these drugs to nations who recognize their nation. And they said, well, he has it. That's a leverage. And he's got the power to back it up. So that's what they're all there to discuss. You know, are they going to recognize it? Is Xavier going to share the drugs? And they're sort of quoting Sun Tzu and, you know, it's not a war if you've already won. And I mean, Xavier, he's holding all the cards here. And so again, I go back to thinking about that quote from Cyclops. Did you think we're just going to take it forever? You know? And so they're kind of talking amongst themselves, you know, are you going to agree? Are you not going to agree? I said, well, you know, we're going to kind of listen to what they have to say. And then we see a couple of the cuckoos come out, invite the ambassadors inside to the Krakoan habitat. And they expect to see Xavier. They say, when will we be meeting with Xavier? And instead it's Magneto that shows up. And he says, Charles won't be joining us today. He's, you know, he's busy doing other things. And I admit I'm a poor substitute, but I'll manage. And the one thing that's interesting about Magneto, he's wearing sort of his traditional costume with kind of a 90s cable belt, utility belt with lots of pouches, except for and like I said, classic costume, except for the fact that it's sort of this white or gray or silver. So I found that to be interesting. I like it. It's a good look, much better than the red and purple, but I wonder what Hickman's thoughts are in changing it. So I think Charles sending Magneto to be kind of the first contact, it makes sense, you know, if you're making these sort of demands. Clearly he's well known. Clearly there's a kind of an inherent threat that's sort of communicating by saying, hey, here's a guy who's, you know, killed before in the name of mutant kind. You know, he's an Omega level mutant, you know, he's really powerful. He's not somebody you want to mess with. So maybe it's Charles sort of subtly trying to say, listen to what this guy says, right? So we even have one of the ambassadors like Magneto. Ambassador's fine. Let me give you a tour. And then on the next page, we're told about the flowers of Krakoa, which is a plant that grows on the nation state of Krakoa, the home of mutants. And it's the only known producer of this flower, basically the primary economic resource of the mutant nation. And at the bottom here, we have four humans, and it gives us the three drugs that are manufactured. There's human drug L, human drug I, and human drug M. And as I said before, one of the drugs that's synthesized extends human life by 5 years. Another is a universal antibiotic. And the third can cure diseases of the mind. And then for mutants, we're told there are some delivery mechanisms of the flower. The flower can grow gateways. It's a pathway from one place to another. It also can produce a habitat. So it's a self-sustaining environment, a biome, basically. Kind of think of it as you can grow your own house, so to speak. And then there's something called No Place, which it's a non-naturally occurring flower produces a habitat that exists outside of the collective consciousness of Krakoa. Place within the island system that Krakoa doesn't know exists. Think of it as a Krakoan tumor. So something inherently secretive about that, and the connotation being that it's not a good thing. It's not in harmony with everything that is trying to go on. Everything else is in red. in the design here in the no place, that one's in black. So again, it's sort of subtly implied that that's not a necessarily good thing. Meanwhile, at the Gray Malkin habitat, so you think of this as the X mansion that was sort of regrown, and it looks like Jean Grey has gathered up a bunch of mutants and they're saying, hey, can anyone travel through a gateway? So again, just a way to give us exposition and sort of explain the sort of the new rules here that Hickman has established. And Jean says, no, mutants can, because Krakoa recognizes its own. Anyone that's not a mutant has to be accompanied by a mutant. And even then, the mutant has to ask permission for the non-mutant to come with them. So we're getting sort of a clue here or explanation that it's not just that Krakoa has become their seat of power and their nation state. Clearly there's some sentience there. And we know, you know, Krakoa is supposedly the living island, but Krakoa itself is trying to be protective, and it's important to have good manners, Jean says. So, you know, again, these are all new rules. So only mutants can go to Krakoa unless they're, you know, somebody who's a non-mutant has to be accompanied by a mutant. And even then the mutant has to ask Krakoa itself, hey, is it okay, you know, if I bring this person in, just trying to be sure that they protect what's theirs. So they all go walking through the gateway. Meanwhile, at Krakoa, we see sort of this control room type place where Cypher is and Sage, and they've sort of built in or come to understand or sort of manipulated the way the habitat has grown. They have an interface, and Krakoa is sort of, it's almost like this techno-organic control room here that they have, and it's reading off who's coming, like incoming Robert Wynn, Sonos Rex, incoming Sean Cassidy, Banshee, incoming Jean Grey, Marvel Girl. And so they know who's coming and who's going at all times. And Sage is talking about, so you built this entire system to manage the traffic network of Krakoa, if you will, you know, how people are coming and going with these gateways that are planted around the world. So she's like, you, Cypher, you built this from scratch. And he's like, yeah, how cool is that? She said, and you coded it in a language that only you and the island can speak, and bioengineered it to run on light and not electricity. So their technology is not dependent on electricity, which would maybe make them dependent on fossil fuels or some other way to generate electricity. It runs on light. And so it's almost like solar power, right? So again, there, it's a way for them not to be dependent on other nations. And I do find it interesting though, that Sage says, okay, you coded this stuff, all this biotechnology that you kind of grew in this network to travel around from place to place, in a language only you and the island can speak. So that makes Cypher pretty darn important if he's the only one that understands it. And I don't know, maybe Sage learns it later on, because we already know there's a Krakoan language, and apparently this is something even different than that. And Cypher says, well, yeah, it's time to get with the program, Sage. You got to bury all that cynicism and replace it with hope. The professor has changed all the old rules, right? And that's really what I feel like this issue is sort of about. This first House of X issue is, but like, okay, now we need to know what the rules are so we can understand what the heck is going on. And then we see all of those new mutants that are arriving, and they see Professor X and Wolverine there, and they run over and say hi. And again, we see Professor X there looking at these new mutants arriving, and it's just the way that he looked. Like, I think a big part of it is just so much of his face is covered, and it's not just his face being covered, because we see that all the time in superhero comics. People wear masks, secret identity, and that kind of thing. But the fact that you can't even see his eyes, I mean, and it's one thing to think about, okay, you can't see Wolverine's eyes. They're, you know, they're white. Same thing with Batman and those kind of things. But at least you see where the eyes should be, and it gives the artist the ability to give us some sort of expression, some show emotion, and give us some insight into what the person's feeling. You get so much of that from the eyes, you know, that expression, the eyes are the windows to the soul. Even if you can't necessarily see the eyeball itself, just, you know, being able to use the eyebrows and such to convey emotion and that kind of thing. Professor X, again, he has this giant fishbowl with an X on it on his head, and the only thing we see is a little bit of his mouth. So it's hard to know what he's thinking. What's interesting here, though, is as he looks at Jean Grey, who's just brought all these new mutants in, says, "Welcome home, Jean. You're all safe here. We all are." And she gets like tears in her eyes. So clearly she feels safe. On the next page, we get another one of the design pages, and it's a map of Krakoa. And we're told about all the different areas. We got House of X, House of M, Arbor Magna, Arena, Akademos Habitat, Transit, the Oracle, the Grove, the Cradle, the Reservoir of the Wild Hunt, and the Carousel. And we don't know what any of that means at this point, other than, you know, House of M. I find that to be really interesting because obviously that was a pretty big deal. That's the whole no more mutants when Scarlet Witch kind of lost it. And as we're recording this is a weekend where Scarlet Witch or WandaVision, I should say. So Scarlet Witch and the Vision TV shows come out. And now apparently based on some of the episodes and things that have happened, people are making a run on those old House of M issues, which weren't really worth that much. But, you know, when speculators jump on something, it's going to drive the price up. So I found that to be interesting. I was reading about that earlier today. Anyway, next page, we see some sort of space station or platform out near the sun. And these people are out there saying, built on the bones of a planet killer, the Forge is our best hope to survive the coming days. And these people dock on this space station, whatever it is, and they start talking about, okay, we need to make repairs. We only have a certain number of time's limited, and we have to, you know, access the environment and see what's going on. And again, don't have any idea who these people are. There's a Dr. Smith, there's a Dr. Kane, there's a Karima. I don't know who any of these people are. So it is curious. So there's space outfits. They do remind me of AIM outfits. They're sort of that round helmet that's flat on the top. So Beekeeper. I did get got a little bit of an AIM vibe there. And then we're told that this forge would have been completed sooner because apparently it was all built by machines, and the machines got the nitrogen and water levels wrong, and they lost everything in the habitat. But it turns out doomsday plans need to be more flexible the closer you get to the sun. So apparently this is some sort of like refuge or weapon. We're not exactly sure. And then we get a clue that this is in response. The reason they're there is in response to what's been going on with Xavier. Because she says, as soon as the predictive models forecasted the extent of what Xavier was planning, Orcus protocols were enacted. We were activated and the automated refit of the station began. So whatever Orcus is, and I know they're supposedly, again, just from not reading any of this stuff, but just covering things. I know Orcus or something is kind of the big bad, if you will. So I'm sure we'll get there at some point. But they are there to weaponize this or in some way have it as like a lifeboat or some sort of safe haven if things go bad. They don't like that Xavier and the mutants are on the road to having so much power on Earth is kind of what I got. And we're told that the robots that built the station aren't there because at the time when these people arrive, those robots are off mining heavy minerals on Mercury. But if they need more machines, they can just build them. So apparently this station, whatever it is pretty self-sufficient. And then right at the end, last scene we see of it is that it looks like it's built around the head of some giant robot. And I don't know if it's supposed to be a celestial. It looks kind of like a giant sentinel head, but I mean, it's way bigger than any sentinel that I've ever seen. And obviously tons of solar panels and what have you, because so close to the sun, it should easily be able to be self-sufficient in terms of energy. But what exactly the head is, and just we're just not sure at this point. So on the next page, it's another one of the design pages. And we're told more about the Orcus protocol. Yeah, basically says establishment of a doomsday network based on evolutionary research regarding the extinction level population density of Homo sapiens. And basically what it's saying is that Homo superior would have already taken out. All right. Are we at that part yet? Oh yeah. That's on the following page. So first we're told that Orcus basically recruited assets from a bunch of different organizations and ones that are all familiar. So AIM, SHIELD, Strike, SWORD, Alpha Flight, Hammer, Arma, Hydra, and plenty of black budget funding from different human-centric financial considerations. And it absorbed and gathered a bunch of resources from all these organizations and built it into a next generation infrastructure that was built for doomsday. So again, a way to survive if the mutants just decide, hey, we have so much power, we're just done with Homo sapiens. And so the three areas of concern and the reason that Orcus was enacted was for population, financial, and territorial. So they wanted to observe mutant influence in case mutants were to try to take over, basically. And so that's the Orcus protocol. And then we get a diagram showing us how it's made up, and it's mostly AIM, 31% AIM, and then shield, strike, sword, alpha flight, hammer, armor, and Hydra in descending order. And then we're told it started 2 years ago that the observation began, and it talked about an increase in the X gene activation spiking. So you're getting more and more mutants showing up. And 6 months ago, there was a financial alert. So apparently Xavier was using shell companies to buy up a bunch of pharmaceutical companies. And that was in preparation to announce these drugs, right? Like he wanted to have control of the pharmaceutical companies, be able to distribute and manufacture and that sort of thing. And then 2 months ago, territorial. So those are the three areas: population, financial, territorial. So 2 months ago, when the mutant nation of Krakoa was established, that was sort of the third trigger, right? That showed them, hey, mutants may be poising themselves to take over. You know, they're putting themselves in a position to take over over the Earth. And then we're also told that there's a Dr. Aaliyah Greger, and she began some research as kind of in humanitarian efforts to repopulate Genosha after the genocide and such. But what she realized when she started studying this was that Homo superior already would have been the dominant species on Earth. And not only was it a spike in the X gene showing up now, but if it wouldn't have been for that genocide in Genosha, that Homo sapiens, like regular humans, would already be the minority species. And because of that, that's part of the reason this Orcus protocol has been enacted, because they just don't know what might happen, like what happens then. And there's I don't know, from my perspective and outside looking in, I'm saying, well, that's the next step in evolution, right? Like we used to be Homo erectus, and then eventually became Homo sapien. There's something else to evolve to. Like, to me, that's something to aspire to, not something to be scared of. But, you know, comics, and also if there's anything that we've seen in society and culture over the last 4 years, especially lately, it's that people definitely fear change and want to hold on to the old ways to the detriment of society, in my opinion. But so this isn't far-fetched at all that that they would say, okay, let's build this crazy space station platform thing that does God knows what, because, you know, we don't want the mutants to be in charge. But I don't know. I always think, hey, if you can't beat them, join them. And then we do get an Orcus command structure, and we're told the director is Dr. Killian Devo. And then second in command, we have three. There's a head of engineering, a military command, and a science command. And then a machine liaison, whatever the heck that is. And she's listed as an Omega Sentinel. So it's Karima Shapandar. So I don't know if she's part machine or what. And then the scene shifts to a damage control contested storage facility. And we see three members of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. We see Mystique, Sabretooth, and Toad. And they're basically stealing data from this place. And they try to escape, and they're trying to get to a gateway. So obviously a gateway to Krakoa, and we're supposed to have been trying to take this data in a clandestine manner. So basically nobody would have known that they took it, but they make a little too much noise. Sabretooth is a little too overzealous. And when they leave the building, they're attacked by Human Torch and the Thing. And so Sabretooth says, you know, I'll stay here. And I've never known Sabretooth to be particularly unselfish, I guess you'd say. But he does say, hey, I got this. Both of you go. He knows how important the data is. And so they make a run for it and head for the gateway. Then the next page, again, another design data dump page, and we're told about damage control. And we've always known damage control. And I think up to this time, damage control has only ever been this corporate entity that basically repairs and rebuilds buildings that are damaged because of superhuman activity. But now we're told that damage control also deals with data issues, right? So in the damage control contested storage facility, they store all kinds of data, schematics, and that sort of material if they're not sure who it belongs to in the case that somebody disappears or dies. So at the time of this issue, Reed Richards is off God knows where, and Tony Stark is supposedly dead. So we did see that Toad said when Mystique was telling him, hey, hurry up and gather the data, he's like, this isn't easy. I'm trying to take all this data from two of the smartest people in the world and, you know, merge it all together and take it without leaving any trace that we were here, which didn't really work out because Sabretooth made too much noise anyway. But then when we get this data page, it says Reed Richards and Tony Stark. So we know, okay, that's what they're trying to get. And there's even a list of items, including a bunch of different Iron Man armors that apparently these guys were trying to get. So the scene then shifts back to that Jerusalem habitat, and we see the Cuckoos and Magneto continuing to give the ambassadors, as it were, a tour, and they show them a bunch of different things. They explain that they have their own language and that sort of thing, and the ambassadors are pretty surprised about that. And Magneto's response to them saying, well, you can't have your own culture without having your own language. So again, it's clear that the mutants and of the Marvel Universe are leveling up, if you will. They're trying to go beyond just, hey, we're a persecuted group, or we're a superhero team. And they're really looking at themselves as something different and setting themselves apart and coming together to form this nation and to form a society and a culture, you know, and they feel like they're going to be stronger together. At least that's, and in a way you think of it, okay, so Hickman's coming up with this idea and saying, yeah, this is what we're going to do. This is the story I want to tell. And in a way it's almost super obvious. Like, why wouldn't they have done this before? Like, and I guess they have sort of to some extent at various times with the, you know, Nation of Genosha and such, but now we're taking it beyond, you know, we're taking it to the next step, saying, yeah, we're going to form our own nation. We're going to have, and we're going to use our own power to do it. And we're going to stand up for ourselves, and we're not going to take people's crap anymore, basically. Whereas Genosha was just more of a, okay, let's gather together and say we're safe, but still sort of playing at being inferior in a way, like all moving there and saying, you know, please leave us alone to sort of live in peace, rather than Xavier isn't asking permission. You know, he's just doing it and then warning everybody. And if you mess with us, you know, you're going to be in trouble, basically. So having a language is all part of that. And Magneto even says, make no mistake, this is exactly what Charles Xavier is doing, creating a distinct culture. You know, it's not enough just to have a nation or a safe haven, but it's a different way of life, a different culture for the mutants. So they go on, they show them other various parts of the habitat. And one of the ambassadors at one point kind of interrupts her and says, don't mean to spoil your grand tour, but can we talk a little bit about the military aspect of all this, about how you have this inherent advantage because you have these gateways from habitat to habitat? You would basically be able to move huge armies any distance unseen, and that kind of upsets the power balance. And don't you think people are going to have a problem with this? And Magneto basically says, well, that's tough. You see this as an instrument of war, but we see it as a refuge, and that's quite different. And there's never been a mutant war. You know, we've never conquered people. We've never stolen their land. We've never, you know, he's calling them out like, okay, look at all these terrible things that humans have done. And we've never done any of that stuff. And that's our advantage. And you know, you can tell they're not buying it. And he's like, well, okay, well, when are we actually going to get to go to Krakoa? And one of the Kuku says, well, that's a point. You don't think of Krakoa so much as a place as it is an idea. But if you mean the main island itself, you won't be going there. And Magneto says, because you've heard the offer. Mutants are the evolutionary next step, right? Like, we're the ones that should be in charge of this whole world. But instead, we're just going to take a small piece of it, and we're giving you the rest. We're only keeping a very small portion. But that portion, it's ours, and man is not welcome there. So, again, drawing a clear line in the sand the way mutants never have before. And meanwhile, we see Toad heading toward the gateway in New York, and Mystique is yelling, Creed, we're leaving. Quit messing around. Let's go. And Mystique jumps through the portal as well. And right as Sabretooth tries to jump through, he's basically trapped in a box by Invisible Woman. And Johnny says, hey, thanks for showing up. How'd you know where to go to cut him off? And Reed is like, well, it seemed pretty obvious once we identified who it was, where they would be going. You know, they'd probably be heading to the closest gateway to escape. And right as he says that, the gateway activates again, and Cyclops comes walking through and says hi to the Richards family, and they sort of exchange pleasantries. And he says, okay, well, it looks like you guys captured Sabretooth. Why don't I take him off your hands? And the Fantastic Four is like, well, why would you let you do that? And Cyclops says, well, you're a smart man. I know you know what amnesty means, because again, that's part of the deal that Xavier has extended the world. You know, we're going to give you these medicines, and we're going to give you these drugs, and all mutants get amnesty, and they all come to live on Krakoa, basically. And Richard says, you know, I understand what amnesty means, but Sabretooth broke some laws, and he injured a bunch of people, and possibly fatal. Are you really going to offer him amnesty for that? And Cyclops like, you know, I know it's upsetting, but this is really a new beginning, and we all need to be on kind of the same page. And Reed doesn't buy it. He's not going along with it. He's like, I have a problem with that. And so you wonder, well, are we about to have a fight here? And Cyclops, I think, probably just buying into the bigger picture, says, okay, fair enough. I can see how strongly you feel about this. And you keep them, and we'll deal with it at another time in another way. So I think Cyclops knows that Sabretooth is, they're going to get him back one way or the other. Fantastic Four are going to be overridden. But it's nice to see this, right? Because in the old days, I feel like it just would have been, okay, here we go, X-Men Fantastic Four fight, or X-Men Avengers fight, or whatever. And they're really showing, by showing restraint, it's interesting. It's sort of a juxtaposition of what you would expect, right? By showing restraint, Cyclops is actually showing power. He doesn't have to fight, because he knows that the powers that be in the government or what have you are going to come to the Fantastic Four and go, okay, you got to give Sabretooth back. We don't care what he did, you know, because what Xavier is offering and the power of a mutant nation of Krakoa is too big of a threat. You know, it's like, you really going to go to war over Sabretooth and Mystique and Toad stealing some data, you know, and causing some damage to a building. So, but Sabretooth for his part, he's like, what are you freaking kidding me? Summers is not happy to be left there. And Sue Storm says, you know, this amnesty and the other things Xavier is doing, like, what are you guys thinking? And this is where, you know, probably the best moment of the issue, where Cyclops says, you know, my family. And again, when he says my family at this point, he's talking about all mutants, because we spent our entire lives being hunted and hated. And the world told me that I was less, like, they were persecuted because they were looked down on. So the world told me that I was less when I knew I was more. Did you honestly think that we were going to sit around forever and just take it? And Sue, you can tell that she's never even thought about that. But her response is, of course not. And Cyclops turns around and says, it's really very simple, Susan. I believe in what Charles Xavier is doing. Please say hi to your son for me and let him know that he's welcome at Krakoa when, you know, whenever he wants. His family is there waiting for him. You know, he's a mutant family. So, I mean, here's the Invisible Woman, right? One of the first superheroes in the Marvel Universe. You know, when you talk about the Marvel Modern Universe, you know, Fantastic Four came first. She never even thought about the fact that they've just been hated on and persecuted and hunted and killed and just beat on like over and over and over and over. And again, the mutants in the Marvel Universe have always been an analog for minorities in the real world. And we've seen examples in the real world, you know, where certain groups have always been persecuted. And every time they sort of push back on that, they're stepped on even more. Well, in the Marvel Universe, the mutants have the power to do something about it. You know, unfortunately, in our world, change is painful and it takes a long time because they maybe don't, some of those minorities don't have that much power, you know, and it's kind of up to us all as a collective to sort of even the playing field. Mutants don't have that problem. You know, they can just say, we're not going to take it anymore. Like, we've had enough of your crap. And we're tired of being beat on and trying to live peacefully and trying to coexist. So instead of just trying, we're just going to leap over you, basically kind of leave you behind. So I thought that was really, like I said, the best moment in the whole issue. We get another design page left, talks about Omega level. What does it mean to be Omega level? I'm not going to get into it. It's read it for yourself if you want, but basically it just means you're the most powerful of that type of mutant, right? So, Magneto, for example, he's the Omega level mutant when it comes to magnetism. Nobody can have more power over magnetism than him. Then the scene shifts back to the Krakoan habitat in Jerusalem. And Magneto is asking, what have you learned? And the ambassador starts to say, well, in order for recognizing Krakoa, and they're like, no, I wasn't speaking to you. And who he's actually speaking to is one of the cuckoos who has basically been examining these people the whole time. And that is where we find out that none of them are actually ambassadors. They're all various secret agents, if you will, or, you know, they're all ex-military. It doesn't come as any surprise. They've all been trained to withstand telepathy, but they're all plants is the way the cuckoo puts it. So one is the head of their state science office. Another is basically a pharmaceutical tech or a pharmaceutical head, you know, head of the pharmaceutical industry in that country. Another is basically a secret agent or a spy. And another is an agent of Strike, and another is an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. So none of them are actually ambassadors or politicians. You know, they're all sent there with their own agendas to sort of find out. One of them's even armed, and Magneto quickly rectifies that situation. And the guy says, I wasn't going to use my weapon. You know, it was just for protection. And, you know, we've all heard that one before. And Magneto even says, yeah, that's how it always starts. And, the cuckoo says, well, should I show him out? And he said, nah, that's not necessary. Some would be offended at a wolf presenting himself in sheep's clothing, but I've learned hard lessons from your kind, so I know the truth. You're all wolves. So Magneto's saying basically here that what he's learned in his time is that all humans are dangerous, you know, no matter what they look like or what they say. And he says, look, this is not a negotiation. Things are different now. And the sooner you realize that, the better off you're going to be. And you should be grateful about the things that we're giving you. Because again, like he said before, they, based on evolution, the whole planet belongs to them now. And they're just going to take a small piece, and they're allowing the rest of the people to continue to exist, basically. And one of the supposed ambassadors said, you know what you sound like? He goes, yeah, I do. And it feels good to finally say it. You know, they're finally standing up for themselves. So the ambassador that's actually the secret agent, she says, well, so you summoned us here to Jerusalem to what? To threaten us? And he says, a promise is not a threat. I summoned you to this place for superficial reasons, right? I know how you humans love your symbolism almost as much as you love your religion. So I wanted you here, and I need you to understand you have new gods now, which to me, that's stepping over the line right there. It's one thing to say, hey, we're better than you, But gods, because that implies some level of worship. And I think, and this might maybe just a failure of Magneto and his giant ego, but I think what, and again, this is assuming that that malevolence or Machiavellian vibe I'm getting from Xavier is not actually true. But it feels like what Xavier is asking for is equality, knowing that they really have the superiority to back it up in terms of strength, in terms of powers, in terms of abilities, in terms of technology, that sort of thing. But he's only asking to be seen as an equal and to be left alone and to build their own culture and their own society. I don't think he's necessarily asking for worship. And when Magneto says you have new gods now, to me, you know, that idea of, hey, we're your gods, that insinuates, you know, a level of deference and worship and supplication. But that's all sort of speculative on my point at right now, because, you know, I don't know. I've only read the first issue. So we get one more design page here before the end, and it says, I have a new word for the lexicon of man, Krakoa. And in the future, when you speak it, make sure you do so softly and with proper deference, for we will be listening, Magneto. So again, you know, it's one thing to show respect, and I think that is where you want to be. And I think that's what Xavier's saying, whereas deference is, that implies something different. That implies, okay, well, mankind is going to put the needs of mutant kind against, you know, above its own needs. You know, you're deferring. If you have to make a choice, okay, we're going to make this choice and 1,000 mutants are going to die or 1,000 humans are going to die. You would expect humankind to choose what's best for them as opposed to what's best for mutants. But when you put that word deference in there, now you're saying, okay, well, I'm sacrificing, or I'm putting the needs of the other group ahead of my own. I'm deferring to them. And I just think that's unrealistic. That's what leads to things like, you know, war and strife and not getting along and suspicion and paranoia and all that sort of thing. But at the same time, I can understand where Magneto's coming from and where Cyclops is coming from for that matter, because for their entire lives, mutants have had to defer to humans. They've had to either stay in hiding or, you know, hide their abilities or just, you know, take it to register their abilities or, you know, be vaccinated against the activation of the X genes. It's always been whatever humans want, the mutants had to defer to. And now Magneto's finally saying, no, now you're going to defer to us for once. So I can see why it would swing back the other way, but what you hope for is the balance. So good start. Again, the only problem I have with it is just the fact that it comes out of nowhere. And these data dump pages in the middle do sort of interrupt the narrative, but most of the time you get one and then the scene shifts anyway. So it is sort of minor. And there is one other data dump page right at the back, but it's the reading order for House of X powers of 10. So yeah, I liked it. There's a lot here, but at the same time, there's still a ton that's unknown, at least to me. But what are your thoughts, John Paul, having, you know, being so far further ahead of me, but now going back and looking at this, do you get more out of it now, going back, now that you've read the end of it? Do you get less? Like, what are your thoughts?
I did get a little bit more out of it because there was a few things that I missed at first. And initially, like the data pages, I was like, I kind of rolled my eyes. I was like, I got to read this. But, you know, this time it was more like paying attention and focus to the data pages because of going forward in the Dawn of X and now into the Reign of X. These little details do present themselves in different ways.
Yeah, and again, it's an interesting way to think about it, because you want to sort of immediately jump on the side of the mutants and say, because what Cyclops is saying is so true. I mean, it's such a great line. Did you think we were always just going to roll over and take it? You know, like,
right.
You keep kicking somebody, eventually they're going to fight back, especially if they have the, you know, abilities that are more than what you have. If you're the weaker species, you know, thinking about like, if you have, you know, 1,000 slaves, let's say, and there's only 20 people that are in charge of those slaves, and you're forcing them to work, and you're constantly beating on them and torturing them and forcing them to work and giving them unbearable conditions to try to survive in. At some point, they're going to realize, hey, we outnumber you. We're stronger than you. We're not going to take this crap anymore, basically. I mean, I think that's just human nature. You know, that's just survival at some point. You know, it comes a choice between us and them, and you have the superior abilities and power. I mean, why wouldn't you? So, again, I think it's interesting, and I think I mentioned it earlier about you kind of wonder that nobody thought of this before, you know, this idea that, that Hickman came up with, because it's a big idea, but at the same time, it's sort of the natural extension of everything that mutants have put up with in the Marvel Universe up to this point.
You know, when reading this, you kind of see that he's been having this in the back of his mind for a while. This idea has been gestating for him, and he's just been waiting to like Marvel for him to get the opportunity to do it. That's what it is, because it seems very thought out and methodical, you know. But that is also how Jonathan Hickman is.
Yeah, exactly. He definitely plays the long game, which I'm sure when he brought this idea to Marvel, they were like, oh, yeah, we, you know, let's go for it. But then it must have been, you know, a lot of planning and a lot of staging and setting things. Okay, how are we going to start? Like, is he going to take over the regular X-Men books? Like, how do you, because again, that corner of the X universe is, or Marvel universe is so big. You know, you've got Wolverine books, you've got, you know, Cable books, you've got X-Men books, you've got just all, you know, so many things. There's always events going on. And, you know, I sort of complain about it being the transition being so abrupt, but it's almost what you had to do, just rip the Band-Aid off, right? Like cancel everything. Mm-hmm. Let's do an event that's, you know, singular, Age of X-Men and X-Men Disassembled and Age of X-Men. So everything is smaller, and then we can bring it all to an end at the same time and then just rip the Band-Aid off and go with this Hickman idea, because it's never going to be the right time in terms of if you're waiting for everything to line up. I mean, that it would have taken years and years of storyline, and they probably wanted to start it up sooner than that, you know? So, I mean, we got the X-Men Disassembled, which was, you know, 10 issues of a weekly story. And then we got Age of X-Men, which was like a 6-month thing. So you got like a good, you know, 7, 8 months, 9 months for them to plan and say, okay, here's everything that Hickman's going to do. And even then, they could only do it in such a way where it's just like, okay, you just end everything and you just start up with this. And as fans and readers, we're all thrown in and say, okay, it'll be explained. Things will become more clear as we go along. Because I just don't see any other way they could have done it. How long do you think it is before I'll be like, okay, I got a good grasp on what's going on. Like, how long do you think it took you before you kind of understood? Do you have to get through the whole limited series of House of X and Power?
Yeah, you pretty much do. You have to get through the whole thing.
Okay.
And to be quite honest, even after passing this event into where we are now, there are some things that still won't make sense. That's because they haven't touched on them yet.
Yeah.
And they won't touch on them for a while. I don't think so.
Gotcha. As far as the art goes, so it's Pepe Larraz, and I do tend to like his art, but I will say that this, and I'm not sure what it is about his art here, but I don't enjoy it here as much as I did in the Extermination. I think Extermination is probably my favorite art I've ever seen him do. And I'm not sure why, like when I go back and look through it, I'm trying to like determine what it is. And it might be the color.
It might be.
Because everything seems to have this, I don't want to say a greenish hue, but it has this like organic sort of feel to it. And I think a lot of that has to do with sort of this technology, this Krakoan technology, the fact that it is organic, you know, things are growing from plants. And so there does seem to be this sort of, there's a lot of green. There's a lot of green. And so I think Extermination as a, you know, 5-issue series, it was much more just traditional superhero fare. And it was, I think the palette was, you know, much more sort of just neutral and typical of a superhero comic. But that's like minor. You know, technically there's nothing wrong with the art. The line work's great. LaRoz is a great storyteller. He does interesting layouts both within the panels and also the way he lays panels out on the pages. If anything, I do wish that he would move the camera angle around a little bit more. I mean, he does it some, but I kind of wish he would do it a little more, only because it's a Hickman book. So there is a lot of dialogue and exposition at times. And so when you're getting like 3 or 4 panels in a row where it's just people talking and they're all the same camera angle, you know, you're all just, okay, I'm looking at this person. It's like a headshot basically, or torso, you know, you're seeing from the shoulders up and they're just talking. And it's 5 panels in a row with different people talking. If you move the camera around in the panel and give us sort of different angles, and he does it a little bit, but I think he needs to move the camera a little more. Like if you're getting one guy from the left and then the next panel, you're just getting somebody else talking there and it's the same like distance and same sort of camera angle just flipped and we're seeing the next guy from the right. It's not that interesting. You know what I'm saying? Like, but if you move it around and it's upshot or downshot or, you know, from far away, silhouette, that kind of thing, it's a little more interesting. But again, that's, I'm being super nitpicky on that. But I'm just trying to kind of analyze it and figure out what it is about it where I noticed, I didn't quite like it as much as I've liked his art in the past. Cause most of the time I'm blown away by his stuff. But it also could just be sort of the pacing. Cause this is, I don't want to say it's interesting actually when we talk about pacing, because I don't want to say it's paced slowly, but the fact of the matter is this is a whole new take on the X-Men, a whole new take on the whole X corner of the Marvel Universe. So there's a lot of information that we're being given and it's very dense. And so because of that, when you're reading it, it takes a while to read it, especially with all the data pages, and it takes a while to process all that. But at the same time, these are big events and a lot of information we're giving, which makes it feel like a lot of things are happening, which typically when a lot of things happen in a book, it's because it's paced and it moves along very quickly. So this is an interesting book because it moves along rather slowly and takes you a long time to read it all. But at the same time, you're getting a lot of information. So it feels like more things are happening than actually are. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting, but that, you know, that's sort of typical of a Hickman book. And I imagine as you gain more knowledge and understanding, then that pace sort of evens out. So it almost feels like it's paced unevenly, especially with the data dump pages where all of a sudden you get all this information. But the one thing I'll say that there's no denying that this is really intriguing and an interesting take. And like I said, it feels like a natural evolution of where the X-Men and mutants have been in the Marvel Universe, prior to this. It's almost like everything that's happened, or, you know, Hickman went back and looked, let's look at the entirety of the history of mutants in the Marvel Universe and what's the next logical, what story hasn't been told, what's the next logical step? And it all goes back to what Cyclops said. Did you just think we were going to take it forever? And how much resentment has been built up over time, you know, how is this really Magneto and Professor X and, you know, everybody else saying, okay, now we're going to create a safe haven for ourselves? Or is that just a prelude to something, you know, a little more fascist? Cause they would have been the dominant species had not the genocide in Genosha happened. So interesting take. And I guess we'll talk more about that as we continue to analyze these issues. So anything else you want to say about this this first issue of House of X?
Oh, well, yeah, as I did my reread, I come to find that I really like the dialogue that Jonathan Hickman writes for Magneto. I feel like he hits the Magneto that I want and who feels powerful and threatening without having to even act, you know? And it's not just in this issue. Every time that he writes Magneto, I'm like, this guy needs to write Magneto all the time.
Yeah. And here's the thing, like Magneto, when he first came on the scene, was a bit of a mustache twirling villain, you know, and then I think they added more depth to him and they added sort of that gray area of saying, well, he's not bad per se, because he's fighting for his kind and the rights of mutants everywhere. And, you know, he only would do terrible things when he was sort of forced to. And he's kind of taking that idea of what Cyclops said to the extreme, you know, like how long are we just supposed to sit here and take it? But you're right. And here, that's all implied. And he doesn't have to say anything sort of, you know, over the top, like do this or else, you know, it's all just there in the way he carries himself. But it is interesting, like I said, that line about, hey, you know, when he tells the humans, the Homo sapiens, yeah, get right, we're your new gods. And that is gods with a little g, not a big g. So I think there's a distinction there. But that's the only part where it's just like the threat is more overt. The rest of the time, right, the threat is pretty, yeah, it's kind of behind the scenes. Like, you know, he even says it, he's like, hey, we're trying to be the good guys here. We could take the whole planet, but instead we're just taking a small part of it, you know? And don't think of this as a negotiation. We're just telling you, hey, this is how it is. And like I said, right from the beginning, when all the ambassadors walked in and I see that it's Magneto that comes out to talk to him, immediately my thought went to, yeah, so there's the implied threat. He doesn't have to say anything just because of the fact that he's Magneto and everything he's gone through. You know, it's inherent in the character. The fact that he was at a Nazi death camp, you know, he lost all his relatives and all his village were all killed by Homo sapiens, you know, by Nazis. There's an inherent, you know, anger underneath the surface of Magneto for what humankind has done to him. And you completely understand it. You know, any of us would feel the anger that Magneto feels. So yeah, you're right. I look forward to seeing how Hickman continues to use Magneto as sort of an inherent threat to sort of see how it all plays out. So, all right. Well, everybody, I think that's going to do it for this episode of X Tuesday. As always, we want to thank everybody for listening and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.